This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. During the last week of September, a contingent led by Jay Peak Resort owner Bill Stenger traveled to China and Vietnam. The mission was to attract EB-5 visa investors for the Northeast Kingdom Development Initiative. The federal EB-5 program offers green card status to foreigners who invest a minimum of $500,000 in approved projects and create at least 10 jobs. Along with business executives were Governor Peter Shumlin and Vermont Secretary of Commerce Lawrence Miller. Before he left on the trip, Governor Shumlin explained why it was important to have members of state government along.
As I talk to my other governors who do a lot of, digging for gold in Asia, whether they're trying to bring jobs in or whether they're trying to export product. In Asia, you have to understand that obviously in China, Vietnam, both countries I'll be in, power is government. In other words, if you have a government position in those countries, you have real clout and real power. So when someone shows up from another government, that's actually probably the most important ingredient for them in understanding that they're talking about something that's real and that they're not just being deceived.
The group has now returned from Asia, and here to speak with us today about the visit and other economic developments in Vermont is Commerce Secretary Lawrence Miller. Secretary Miller, nice to have you back on Vermont Edition.
It's great to be with you, Jane.
Can you give us an idea of who you met, who you talked with in China and Vietnam?
Well, over the time we were there, we saw about 500 or more individual investors who came to seminars and meetings with our group. We also talked to a great many agents, immigration lawyers, people who work in the supporting industry in China for helping Chinese investors make foreign direct investments, including the EB-5 program. So we had a parallel mission with Jay Peak. We wanted to see them be successful gaining individual investors, and we also wanted to make sure that the professional community understood the advantages of Vermont investment.
Those 500 or so investors that you spoke with, how much did they actually know about Vermont before you presented your presentations?
They knew a great deal about the individual projects. These are very significant investments for folks. They've had information at their disposal to begin the investigation process. This is an opportunity for them to meet Bill, meet their purported business partner or their hoped-for business partner, and to take their due diligence to the next step. It also gave them an opportunity to ask us about doing business in Vermont, which we're always happy to be able to tout.
What kinds of questions did they ask about doing business in Vermont?
A lot of interesting questions around what the educational opportunities are in Vermont. It's interesting. About 80% of the investors were really looking at the question of how their kids could access higher education in the United States and then be able to stay and practice in their discipline of choice. As you know, so many people come to the United States for higher education. As soon as they've gotten their master's or PhD, the federal government kicks them back out of the country. We'd like to make sure there's a way for more of them to stay here after they've learned all this great knowledge and developed these skills. And that's really well aligned with the EB-5 investors. So they understand the importance of education. They understand the importance of education to a robust economic development environment. And that seemed to be the most common question is what's the workforce development opportunities in Vermont? What are the educational opportunities in Vermont? And then to a lesser degree, but very common questions, access to market, proximity to New York, Boston, and Montreal turn out to be very important. All of the fundamentals to a basic success of a business.
And just to back up for just a moment on that education question, because it sometimes gets a little confusing, I think. The deal is with the EB-5 visa, the foreign investor, can bring over his or her family, and dependents who I would assume are under 18 at the time are also allowed onto that green card. And so then, therefore, after finishing education in the United States, might be able to stay.
Yes, it's the investor, their spouse, and their children under the age of 21 when they make the investment.
Okay, so even students who might be in college, if they're under 21, they can get the green card.
That's correct.
When you're talking about something like the EB-5 visa program, is that really a big carrot for them? I mean, if they have all this money to invest, at least $500,000 in a project in a rural place like Vermont, is the EB-5 visa program, because that ability to get a green card for your dependents, really a big carrot?
It is the carrot. It is the majority of the return that they're looking for in that investment. They're very careful about wanting to make an investment that they're going to get their money back and that they're going to get a small return on. But this is not typical return rates that you would see in investing in this type of business. If somebody's just looking for a financial return, this kind of investment, they might be looking for something in the 10 to 15% annual return rate. When you combine the value of the green card with the investment, then a very patient capital return rate of a few percent annualized becomes an acceptable return for them on the financial side with the enhancement of the green card.
We're talking today with Commerce Secretary Lawrence Miller about his recent trip to Asia with Governor Shumlin to drum up support for economic development. We're also going to look at other economic issues facing the state. And listeners, you can share your questions for the secretary by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or go ahead and post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We'd like to know if you have any questions about foreign investment in the state, what that might mean for the Northeast Kingdom and beyond. And other questions, unemployment rate, still very, very low and going down compared to last year. What do you see in Vermont's economy? Again, 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Robert, Secretary Miller, who says, "My research into the EB-5 program hit a wall when the minimum cost for a project was $10 million. I know there are other projects just as important to Vermont communities that do not reach the minimum requirements to be considered for the EB-5 program. Will the Northeast Kingdom Economic Development Initiative program allow for smaller projects to be applied for and considered? And when or how should one go about applying?" Kind of a technical question there.
Yeah, if you've got a project that you want to explore the feasibility of EB-5 financing, Brent Raymond in our office, who runs the International Trade Office in the EB-5 Regional Center, is the best person to talk to start the conversation. He'll refer people to economists and immigration attorneys who are active in the state so that people can continue those conversations with the professional advisors. It isn't so much that there's a hard limit of $10 million. It's that everything that goes into preparing an EB-5 project, including the econometric analysis that will be used to validate the job creation data, the private placement memorandum, and then the travel that's necessary and the networking that's necessary to build the investor connections.
You mean like the trip you just took?
Like the trip we just took. It adds up to a lot of money. And so what we found is that below about $10 million, the effective cost of doing the financing makes it much more expensive than conventional financing or finding other types of investors. And so we are trying to develop ways to help businesses bring those costs down, but we also don't want to lead somebody down a path that they're going to wind up spending a lot more money in financing costs than they need to move forward with their project.
And again, that $10 million, that's the cost of the project itself, obviously not the cost of each person's investment in it.
That's right. If you have a financing need of around $10 million, EB-5 begins to make sense as a financing source, provided that the characteristics of the project are suitable for EB-5 investors. And EB-5 investors in different parts of the world look at projects differently. It's real estate projects sell very well in Asia. A little more tolerance for operating companies in Europe. It's a diverse mix.
Let's go to Stephen calling in from Burlington. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm very skeptical about the EB-5 program because I see it as a gateway for rich people to acquire entry into the United States. I wonder a couple of things. One is, Is there a screening done to make sure that none of these people is actually criminals or other way unqualified for entry into the United States? And another question I have is, what happens if the $500,000 doesn't produce 10 jobs? Do they get kicked out? Is there any accountability?
Yeah, Stephen, thanks for the question. Secretary Miller?
Sure, those are good questions. USIS, United States Customs and Immigration Service, vets each investor thoroughly. And the investor has to be able to demonstrate that their $500,000 came from legitimate sources, that they've had control of these funds for at least 5 years, and that it's all traceable. And they're subject to the same sort of background checks that all immigrants undergo. So feel very good about the level of protections that are in place around who those immigrants may be. The other thing that I'd like to say about that is that, you know, Vermont has done a great job of opening its arms to all kinds of immigrants in wave after wave, including folks in truly desperate plights getting out of places like Bosnia, Sudan. So this is a slice of our immigration picture. There's only about 10,000 of these visas available in any given year. In the entire country. So, you know, I think it's important to note that it's a small slice and Vermont does its share in the broader immigration solution for folks who are escaping truly dreadful circumstances. And then on the question of, you know, what happens if the jobs don't get created? If the investment, this is an entirely at-risk investment and the green card is entirely at risk. 2 years after the investment is made, the window begins to open for doing an I-829 petition and proving to USIS that the jobs have been created, that the investments were made as expected. And only when that proof is delivered does USIS release the conditions on the green card. So it's temporary until those jobs are proven.
Yes, most green cards are conditional until certain circumstances are met, whether it's a EB-5 green card or a green card that you've gotten by way of marriage or something like that. There are usually conditions placed on that before somebody is given an unconditional green card.
Yep.
Let's go to Scott, also in Burlington. Hey, Scott, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. Just a quick note. I've spent a career working internationally like a number of Vermonters, and one of the ironies of doing international development work is that you note that the amount of capital that flies out of countries dwarfs the amount of actual investment that comes in from donor countries. That is, money made there, capital made there, brains developed there, flee, and countries are left, the population, the poor are left essentially on their own in poverty. And this whole program, to me, has some interesting questions related to that fact. Basically, it is a program that, at the end of the day, promotes capital flight, promotes brain drain from developing countries. And I'm just wondering how we as Vermonters feel about contributing to that.
Yeah, Scott, good point. Hold that thought. I want to take a call from Jim, and then we'll get considerations from Secretary Miller on both of those. Jim, go ahead.
Hi. I guess I'm more like Steve from Burlington. I've always been skeptical of this program and don't claim to fully understand it. But it seems like extortion to me that you got to pony up so much money to get into the game. And if you don't have the money, you don't get into this country. And now I'm hearing the plan is we hope people stay. They bring their kids for higher education. And I'm living here all my life, and now I got to worry about a SWAT at UVM being taken up by somebody else. Now I'm even more skeptical of the program.
Thanks. All right, Jim, yeah, thanks for your comments. Secretary Miller, a couple people there now saying, ooh, they're having some reservations about this program.
Sure, and, you know, let's be clear. This is a federal program, and our responsibility is to bring capital into Vermont and help grow our economy here. And when we've got a tool like EB-5 that's available to us, we're going to take the best advantage of that tool as we possibly can. I believe that
But let me stop you there for just a second, because, you know, one of the things that you work on as Commerce Secretary and that we've been concerned about in Vermont for 200 years is brain drain and youth flight and losing valuable people in this state to other places that can give a more attractive offer. And it sounds like what Scott is saying is, aren't we doing the same thing by trying to draw them here to Vermont with the EB-5 program ethically? Is that what we want to be doing?
Well, and to me, it's about creating as many exchanges around the world as we possibly can. We are not an isolated place. We are in a very connected global world. And I think that anything we can do to improve our connections throughout the world is really important. So what we consistently see is that people who move around the world maintain their connections to their home country. They maintain their connections in commerce and in families and create additional opportunities. So this is – our effort is not around siphoning people away, but in creating those connections. If people want to invest some of their money and, you know, by definition, this should be a minority piece of their portfolio or they shouldn't be investing in this kind of thing. They've also got investments in their home country. You know, I think that's a good thing. And the extent to which we can build relationships and other trade opportunities that create opportunities for folks in those countries is an important piece of the puzzle. In our conversations in Vietnam, it became very clear that there were some opportunities around agricultural exchange that we should pursue. And so when I got back, I talked to Secretary Ross about how do we facilitate that kind of conversation. It's not just grabbing money.
Mm-hmm. A couple of quick questions. One from Edward in Guildhall, who called in but couldn't stay on the line, wants to know, how can we expect to lure businesses here when we can't even maintain consistent internet service for the businesses we already have?
Well, we're certainly trying to build out the broadband connectivity throughout the state. I think there's actually down to fewer than 200 addresses that are identified that don't have a broadband project to make sure that they do have high-speed, stable service going forward. So broadband is absolutely a key infrastructure piece. In terms of luring businesses to Vermont, though, I think one of the things that we find over and over again is that businesses that locate in Vermont because of some other connection, those are the folks who will come to Vermont. We don't have any track record, and I don't think any state has any real track record of success luring businesses from away. A bunch of states try to do it with big tax breaks and state giveaways. The businesses are there until those are gone, and then they take flight. What we find is that nurturing Vermont businesses and working the supply chains to attract their business partners, working with second homeowners, working with graduates of Vermont schools, those are the ways to attract Vermont businesses new Vermont businesses to locate here and expand.
We're talking today again with Commerce Secretary Lawrence Miller. More with him in just a moment. We're looking about his recent trip to Asia to attract investment to Vermont, developers to Vermont through the EB-5 visa program. We're also going to talk with him about other issues facing the state. And you can share your questions by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been talking with Commerce Secretary Lawrence Miller about his trip to China and Vietnam with the governor to help entice foreign investors to the state. Lots of you have questions about this and how this will work, and you can share those by posting on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Or if you have questions about that or other economic issues facing Vermont that the Commerce Secretary is dealing with, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Secretary Miller, a lot of people with questions about the EB-5 visa program, and certainly we're hearing an awful lot about it as trips like these come up, as we look at development in the Northeast Kingdom. Eric has a question saying, as Vermont courts foreign investments, what needs for translation and interpretive services do you foresee? And has the state taken any steps to identify a cadre of qualified translators and interpreters in the languages involved?
Well, I think one of the things I don't think I completely answered a previous caller's question around was folks coming to Vermont as part of their investment. And I think one of the things I should clarify is that these EB-5 investors are getting a federal – this is part of a federal program, so they can settle anywhere in the United States. Just because they're making a financial investment in a Vermont company doesn't mean that they are coming to Vermont. And frankly, I'm not aware of any EB-5 investors who have selected Vermont as their residence.
Really? So all of the people who are saying they'll invest in the J-Peak expansion project so far are saying they will do that and they will live in the U.S., but they will live elsewhere.
We just don't know where they're going to live. That's not one of the questions we asked. But we have not seen of the hundreds of investors. I'm not aware of anybody who's chosen to live full time in Vermont at this point.
So probably interpretive services not as necessary as if they were living here, but certainly they're still going to have to interact with other investors.
Yeah, interpretive services are absolutely critical in making sure that people have the ability to get all of the correct information they need to make a investment decision. And it became really clear to me in our travels that not only do you need a professional interpreter with you when you're having these conversations, we had a very skilled interpreter with us. You also need somebody who is familiar with the program and the legal restrictions so that you've got somebody who can translate and interpret within that environment. And we've got a couple of firms in Vermont who do that work, not in all languages. So you go and find the best folks for the specific language you're working in. It's also true that there are so many people around the world who use English as the language of business that finding local support is remarkably easy.
Let's hear from Don, who's on the line with us from Richmond. Hey, Don.
Hello. I was thinking that part of some of the earlier callers were mentioning the ethical issues and it's an entry for rich folks and stuff like that. Particularly in Vermont, we're absorbing, we've been absorbing refugee populations for a number of years, and by 10,000 federal permits, it seemed like the number, if they were indeed coming to Vermont, and that doesn't seem to be the case, that the numbers would be relatively small in comparison. My second point was, there was an article, and I don't remember where I read it, where somebody was assessing the amount of money that gets sent back to home countries from immigrants. And this is not necessarily specific to the U.S., but the number was something like $420 billion annually, which the point that was being made in the article was that it dwarfs any foreign aid.
So you see this as a potentially a good thing, Don, for both Vermont and for the foreign countries themselves.
Absolutely, because this is a scale, say, in the Northeast Kingdom that you typically don't see startups. They're just not doing it.
Yeah.
Startups we see are much smaller scale, and if they're lucky, they're able to build into something that then might be swallowed up by a national company.
I hear what you're saying, Don. Thank you very much for making that point. Appreciate it. Let's go to Gil in Montreal. Hey, Gil, go ahead.
How are you?
Well.
I worked a number of years for a worldwide developer of properties, and I was involved in some work in Vermont. There's some challenges to working in Vermont and to bringing wealth to Vermont from an outside perspective. It's just natural. Well, the process tends to be careful and slow, which is justifiable. If you want to have development or if you want to have infrastructure work or things like that, you have to do it carefully. Vermont has its nature. It's distant from certain markets and it's certain terrain, and it's the availability of resources to develop Vermont, to improve Vermont, to help jobs. It can be a challenge. And so, any way that it is possible to get capital into Vermont is very valuable. And I was working with a number of, developers north and south, and when the investments, and I tuned in late, so I apologize if I'm not on the right segment, but when investment into the country, fueled by immigration investment, started coming into Vermont, that was it was very, very much looked upon by developers as an opportunity to utilize and improve things that normally would not have been, able to be improved. And that, as far as I understand, is valuable for jobs. It's been valuable to help kickstart certain things.
Yeah, Gil, thanks for the point. Appreciate that. You know, interestingly, Commerce Secretary Miller, Gil calling from Montreal, I want to move on a little bit because there's certainly a lot of other stuff going on, although clearly this question and questions relating to the EB-5 visa program are resonating with people as we hear more about it. But Gil calling in from Montreal, there's some interesting developments now cross-border here with trying to make sure that we have even more connections to our neighbors in Canada and making sure that transportation corridors are up and running to make sure that can happen. Can you talk a little bit about the developments with transportation?
You know, absolutely. Quebec is, Canada overall is our largest trading partner, and Quebec commands the lion's share of that. And certainly across the northern tier of the state, there's many people with family across the border. The single biggest infrastructure issue we've got on the border, frankly, is the border crossings issue. We've got to have more staff on the border. Wait times in some places are really burdensome. The cuts that have happened on the border over the years have really impaired the ability of the officers working the border to get people through in a reasonable period of time. So that's something that the federal delegation is very engaged with, that we're working on. The highway that'll start to be completed in phases north of Highgate, I think is going to be a tremendous advantage, be able to see a good increase in travel there. But we have to make sure the border crossing is prepared. The port of Montreal is a massive container port. It's a huge strategic advantage to shippers and to importers who might locate in Vermont. The train getting up and running all the way through Montreal and getting pre-clearance at the Montreal train station. You know, each of these connections.
Pre-clearance to cross the border, you mean?
Pre-clearance across the border so that the train, everybody can clear customs in Montreal before coming down to the United States, the same way that you're able to do at the airport, rather than having the train stop for an hour or two at the border crossing.
And how far are we, or how close are we to actually making that happen?
There's a lot of good conversations about it. I do think it's on track for sometime in the next couple of years.
And you also mentioned the highway, where we've been making road improvements so that people heading between, say, Burlington and Montreal, or points in between those two locations, are able to get there quicker. And that is moving apace. There's a stretch that's going to open not too long from now.
Yeah, I think the first section opens next year, and then the most significant section, I believe, opens in 2015. A good example of why our proximity to Montreal is important and why connectivity and shorter driving times is important is look at the game development community in Montreal, probably the international center, Electronic Arts, all of the big game firms have locations there. And we have a strong game developer community that's building up in Burlington, with what's going on in the Emergent Media Center at Champlain, with some of the software development firms. These are strong where they are, partly because they are so easily connected to this global hub of game development in Montreal.
Moving on to another issue that certainly occupies the minds of many, our unemployment rate is quite low, but we're still seeing people who are worried about making enough money. Underemployment still an issue, as it always is. As of August of this year, the state unemployment rate was 4.6%. That's down about 0.5% from August of last year. But in that time period, we've also lost 4,000 people in the civilian labor force. What actually accounts for that? Is that an aging workforce, or are people discouraged and dropping out?
Well, none of the economists I've talked to have a really clear picture of what's happening structurally with our workforce. We're aware of an aging workforce. We're aware that people might be making decisions about how much they want to work. And we're aware of a shift to perhaps some more freelancing and independent work. What I look at with some level of concern is that we've got this great low U3 unemployment rate, the general unemployment rate. But as you said, we've got an underemployed population. So if you look at the U6 or broader unemployment rate that includes discouraged workers, people who if they were given the opportunity to have a full-time job, might take it traditionally, you know, that spread is another 4.5% or 5%. And before the recession, that spread was about 2% difference. And so I think until we have less underemployment, we're not going to see the wage growth that is most important in a healthy economy. We've got a lot of people still to come back into the labor market. But as you said, we're seeing people drop out of the labor force. We're seeing some changes across all age ranges. And I'm not sure that there isn't something more structural going on that we don't quite understand.
So, Secretary Miller, what is your top priority moving forward here? You've been in the job about 3 years now. What are you really honed in on?
You know, I think if you look at any economy, the single biggest indicator of how healthy that economy is going to be and how healthy the people who that economy serves are actually going to be is education. So our participation in the long-term conversation about improving educational outcomes and increasing educational attainment, you know, is clearly a big area for us to focus on, making sure we make this healthcare transition as gracefully as possible with as little collateral impact as possible and make Vermont a better place to employ folks as a result. That's also a really big area. Driving out broadband, lifelong learning, you know, those are the meaningful areas. At the same time, we like to improve permit process and international connections.
That's a lot to focus on.
It's a lot.
But you're liking the job still? You didn't ask for this job. As we know, you were picked for it and sort of plucked out of private industry.
I'm having a great time. It's a lot of different challenges and a lot of great people to work with. You know, the state workforce often gets a bad rap. I really appreciate all of the people I get to work with throughout state government. A lot of very dedicated people doing really creative work under often challenging circumstances.
Lawrence Miller is the Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Secretary Miller, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, speaking of people who work in creative fields, we're going to look at a 24-hour hackathon coming to Vermont on Friday evening and running all through the night and beyond. And we'll find out how the government shutdown may be affecting their work. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This Friday evening, teams of computer programmers will gather at the Champlain Mill in Winooski to start 24 hours of coding. It's part of the third annual Hack VT competition. Tim Kenny is president and CTO of My Web Grocer, one of the sponsors of the hackathon, and he's with us now. Hello, Tim.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the hackathon. I mean, I think people now are pretty familiar with hackers and hackathons, but explain what this is doing and how it's all for a good cause.
Well, we like to put Vermont on that creative tech map. This is the third annual Vermont Hackathon, where the developers get together, and the challenge is in 24 hours to build a killer app for the state of Vermont. So it could be a web-based application, could be a mobile-based application, and they're up for real prizes, cash prizes, and we end up with some great local sponsors that help sponsor this event, which really highlights some of the creative software talent we have in the state.
When you say up for real prizes, like what?
There's $20,000 in cash and prizes that's up for grabs.
So is this, though, mostly a labor of love or passion for people? Because $20,000 distributed among all the teams is still not a ton of money. You're not making your career on this.
That's true. We'll have more than 150 participants by the time it's done. I don't think people do it for the money. Part of the competition makes it fun, but people do it for the fun of coming. And also, there are people who are very passionate about wanting to start an effort to build an application to solve a certain problem for the state or to highlight something they love about the state. And you'll see some of those works, and I love the judging session at the end, and we have some great local judges, too, that help us out with this. And the creativity and the passion you see in what people have built in a very short amount of time.
obviously, we don't know what they're going to build this Friday, but can you give us some examples of that kind of creativity from the previous two hackathons?
Oh, sure. You'll see things, everything from tourism-type apps, which highlight some of the best places to visit in the state. We had one last year where they built a business landscape application for business trends over time and by sector in the state. We had a builder, Vermont Prospective Builder app, to help you navigate complex issues around that. And we had one on housing costs last year. We also had a number that were a lot of fun on the beer industry in the state, but unfortunately none of those were winners.
Unfortunately for you, you're a beer fan, I take it.
Yeah, I'm a beer fan. I was hoping for one of the beer apps, but none of them made it to the final round.
We're talking today about the Hack VT competition. It's a 24-hour hackathon. It starts Friday night at 6 p.m. We're talking with Tim Kenny with MyWebGrocer. MyWebGrocer, one of the sponsors of the hackathon. Now, Tim, you mentioned that the hackers are using all of these data sets to get their information to create these apps, like the beer one. People aren't creating these out of thin air. They're using applications and data sets from other places. And one of the understandings we have is that some of them come from the federal government and may actually be affected by the shutdown because, as we know, certain data sets that are being formulated frequently, often ones related to agriculture, for example, aren't being populated. Now, I understand that you don't know much about where those data sets are going to come from, but how do generally the hackers find out the information that they then need to use to create these creative apps?
So we spend probably a good couple of months ahead of each hackathon, scrubbing and looking for data that we think would be interesting for the competitors to use. And in that scrubbing and looking, you do run across a number of federal data sets, including like one that we know is down right now, like census data, which was used in
If you try to go to the census website right now, you can't find anything. That whole website is down.
That's correct, and the data sets would be served through the website. So this year, if someone was coming in with the idea of that's where I plan to go get the majority of the data for the application I was going to build, they wouldn't be able to build that application this year. So they'll have to be creative with the data sets that are live, and they'll have to look in real time on Friday and see whether they're there or not.
So you're actually asking people to be perhaps even more creative this year, maybe not the app that they were planning to build.
Maybe built more on Vermont's data sets so that we serve out of the state here.
You mentioned that you love the judging part of this after the teams have created their apps. Is it fun for the judges? I imagine it's both fun but also fairly stressful.
I don't think it's very stressful. I did it 1 year myself, and it is fun to see the what these people can create in just 24 hours isn't very long to write an entire application and then get up and present it. And they're typically tired and a little bit silly by then, which adds to some of the fun. But they're typically applications that can be fully demonstrated and they work. What's stressful is having to choose, since some of them can be so good, and finding the top three is really the hard part.
Well, beyond then the actual judging of this competition and awarding winners, do these apps make it out of the Champlain Mellon Winooski? I mean, are these useful to the state?
It's up to the people who have made the application, or if they picked some. We have some state agencies that put in requests for groups that don't come in with their own ideas. They would have to follow up with the application developers, or the application developer would have to let them know that they developed an application they requested, and then follow up on that. But I am positive that some of these make their way into websites and applications, for example, in the Apple Store. If you go search for some things, you may find that these were the seeds of what became a commercial offering by someone later, because they're well on their way towards making something that that is real and tangible, and the launching part of it isn't the big work after that.
Tim Kenny is president and CTO of My Web Grocer, one of the sponsors of the third annual Hack VT competition. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And a reminder, the hackathon starts Friday night at 6 p.m. and runs for 24 hours in Winooski. We have details at vpr.net. If you're headed to an unfamiliar restaurant or looking for a good hotel on your vacation, you might check Yelp or TripAdvisor for tips from previous customers. But people with disabilities often have difficulty getting accurate information about accessibility. Does the business have a ramp? Is there handicapped parking? That's where a new Vermont website comes in. Peter Criff is executive director of the Vermont Statewide Independent Living Council. They've created a website called Accessible Adventures, and we asked Criff to describe it to us.
Well, the kind of things that are up there now is that you can review and search information on restaurants, on shopping, on public places, on recreation, public parks, public buildings, and, you know, you can go in and evaluate those places for different kinds of disabilities, and then you can make comments. Somebody with a disability can go out to a place and say, hey, this place was good for my disability, but it might not be good for yours.
And is that how you hope people will use it? They'll figure out, you know, here's my disability. I'm trying to find out a restaurant to go to or a hotel to stay in or someplace else, and I just don't know whether it'll work for me.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. And, you know, the peer-to-peer information is actually much more valuable than any information that is published because people trust other people that are in the same situation that they are.
Well, and I'm looking at one here, the Breakwater Cafe and Grill in Burlington. Mm-hmm. And Deb has commented to one of the users on the site and says both indoor and outdoor seating right on the lake, aisles between tables outdoors are marginal, but the tables and chairs are easily movable. So some kind of information like that is helpful to people who might be trying to figure out if they can actually go have dinner in their wheelchair somewhere?
Absolutely. You know, aisle width in restaurants, as well as accessibility to restrooms are, you know, really, really important to the quality of experience. And, you know, so that's something for someone to think about, you know, whether, because for some people in wheelchairs that have more mobility than others in the same situation, the Breakwater Cafe may be a fine place. Depending on what your abilities are, it might not be the greatest choice for certain people.
And what are people saying so far about how they utilize the site?
Basically, people are saying that it's really great, but right now there isn't a lot of information on there. We just sort of launched a service a couple weeks ago. We have probably 300 to 400 reviews on there, which is great. But, you know, there's a lot more places in Vermont to go than that. So we're really asking people, volunteers, organizations, to really put data in our database, because then it will be a better reference tool.
You've also updated the site to allow it to be now a sort of a two-way conversation between customers and businesses. So the businesses are now alerted when somebody has reviewed them. Why is that important?
Well, it's important to us. So that the first time the business community doesn't hear from us, it's like some kind of a legal action. So it starts a conversation, and while things may not be perfect, even if the facility didn't get a good review, quote, there are links and suggestions about how to make things better and how to get a free evaluation, how to make things better.
Have any businesses replied online yet?
Well, you know, it's kind of too early to tell, but there's 3 or 4 businesses that have most of the reviews that we've gotten right now actually have been positive. We don't have really any outstanding negative reviews. And so we're trying to essentially model good accessibility. And so most of the reviews that we have now are positive. But, you know, as more data gets in, I'm sure there will be less positive reviews.
Yes, which I suppose is one of the valuable parts of the site. I mean, this isn't just supposed to be a booster site. It's supposed to be a way for people who need to know if some place is going to be accessible, how accessible it is.
That's right. You know, and save people time also. You know, it's like, say, some family wants to go out to eat in Montpelier and they're unsure about a friend or a relative's capabilities, they can actually go online and search it out and then be, you know, much more certain of the place that they're going to go will be a happy time for everybody.
Peter Criff is Executive Director of the Vermont Statewide Independent Living Council, the creator of a website called Accessible Adventures. We have a link at vpr.net. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
And that will do it for today. Tomorrow, late season garden questions. The weather is turning, the leaves are falling, and it's time to put the garden to bed. We'll talk with Charlie Nardozzi about how to do just that and what you can still harvest or even plant right now. Post your gardening questions at vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.